I think the president lives in an alternative reality world.
We all do now, Madam Mayor. We all do, apparently.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, where it's 100 degrees in late October, this is the broadcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, up in Oregon on 91.7 KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 KSO in Cottage Grove, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania on 92.9 WLRI, in Maui, Hawaii on 88.5 KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN 94.1, in Palenville, New York on 102.9 WLPP, in Grand Rapids, Michigan on WPRR, in New Orleans on 102.3 WHIV, in Washington, D.C. on 105.5, and in Minneapolis, St. Paul on AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day, no matter how warm, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Deprogrammed Radio, Workforce Rising, Detour Talk, and Radio Sputnik. Blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us. Desi Doyen, not strange at all that it is 100 degrees out here in Los Angeles, and it is almost Halloween.
Yeah, late October. Yeah, nothing weird about that at all.
Nothing to worry about, and that's going to continue for the next several days. Let's hope the fires don't torch up again down here in Southern California. But right now, heat is the least of our problems, it seems, at least for the immediate circumstances. In a rare joint appearance on Saturday night, all five living former presidents, Jimmy Carter, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George H.W. Bush, and Barack Obama, gathered for a fundraising concert to help those affected by the record-breaking hurricanes that struck Texas, Florida, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. President Trump did not attend the fundraiser. He sent a videotaped message, choosing instead to spend the weekend at one of his golf courses. The sold-out concert at Texas A&M University raised more than $31 million in private funds from 80,000 donors, but of course it will take far more than that, tens of billions, in fact, to fully recover from these storms, these record storms. And nowhere right now is the damage and suffering still more widespread and desperate than across much of Puerto Rico. Coming up, we will be joined by a former Puerto Rican energy commissioner, now on the Sierra Club's National Board of Directors, warning that as the island of 3.5 million U.S. citizens continues to struggle to survive, they must beware of vultures descending on the island.
Oh, goody.
Particularly when it comes to rebuilding the nation's energy grid. No, not actual vultures, the economic kind. That energy grid is still down across most of the island. more than a month now after the hurricane made landfall, with some 80% of its citizens still left in the dark. So anyway, not literal vultures, but the economic kind. He will be here to talk about that, as he is just back from the island himself, to explain the circumstances on the ground and how Puerto Rico can and should move forward. In the meantime, where natural disasters are not enough for the U.S. to struggle with right now, our president still seems dead set on creating a man-made disaster himself. While much of the media are distracted, it seems, by the ugly, unbelievably ugly politics coming out of Washington, D.C., largely from the president of the United States, worries persist about his reaction to nuclear-armed North Korea. President Donald Trump on Sunday struck an ominous tone with remarks on North Korea, saying the U.S. is prepared for anything, but it would be nice not to do that, whatever that means. He said, we are prepared for anything. We are so well prepared like you wouldn't believe. This in an interview on Fox News on Sunday. He said, you would be shocked to see how totally prepared we are if we need to be, he added. Would it be nice not to do that? The answer is yes. Will that happen? Who knows, he said. What was he referring to there? Well, you take your pick. The White House has announced that Trump will ask U.S. allies to put pressure on North Korea regarding its nuclear program when he travels to Japan, South Korea, China, Vietnam, and the Philippines from November 3 to November 14 for what will be his longest foreign trip to date. What could possibly go wrong there? An unnamed White House official on Monday who briefed reporters on the upcoming trip said in what I think is probably good news that Trump is unlikely to visit the demilitarized zone separating North and South Korea during his visit.
Oh, that is good news.
I think it is good
news. Let's hope they stick to it.
According to the Washington Post, Trump plans instead to speak to U.S. and South Korean troops at Camp Humphreys, which is about 55 miles south of Seoul. That at the invitation of South Korean President Moon Jae-in. According to the White House official, as reported by the Washington Post, they note that since Ronald Reagan, every American president except for George H.W. Bush has visited the DMZ, the heavily guarded strip of land that has divided North and South Korea for some 64 years. The Trump administration has reportedly been divided over whether they should send Trump to the DMZ. Not to the DMV, but to the DMZ.
It's a little different.
Yeah. Amid concerns from the South Korean president and the U.S. State Department that a visit like that could further inflame tensions with Pyongyang, and we do not need those tensions to be further inflamed right now. The White House official said that Trump's personal security was not the concern. He's not afraid. He's not avoiding it because he's afraid, they want us to know. But that there is just not enough time for the president to visit both Camp Humphreys and the outpost along the border on that 12-day overseas trip to Asia. As noted, I think that's probably good news. Less good news, however, comes via an exclusive over the weekend from Marcus Weisgerber of the national security news outlet Defense One. This is troubling to me. The U.S. Air Force is preparing to put nuclear-armed bombers back on 24-hour ready alert, a status not seen since the Cold War ended in 1991, says Weisgerber over at Defense One. That means the long-dormant concrete pads at the end of the 11,000-foot runways at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana could once again find several B-52s parked on them. Laden with nuclear weapons and set to take off at a moment's notice. This is yet one more step in ensuring that we're prepared, General David Goldfein, Air Force Chief of Staff, said in an interview. Prepared for what? He said, I look at it more as not planning for any specific event, but more for the reality of the global situation we find ourselves in and how we ensure we're prepared going forward. Prepared to drop nuclear weapons from planes? Really? Where? On whom? Goldfein and other senior defense officials stressed that the alert order had not yet been given, but that preparations were underway in anticipation that it might come. Putting the B-52s back on alert is just one of the many decisions facing the Air Force as the U.S. military responds to a changing geopolitical environment. That includes North Korea's rapidly advancing nuclear arsenal, reports Defense One, President Trump's confrontational approach to Pyongyang, and Russia's increasingly potent and active armed forces. This news outlet says, really? We're arming because of Russia? Putting nuclear weapons onto planes because of Russia? Really? Please. The world is a dangerous place, and we've got folks that are talking about openly about the use of nuclear weapons, Goldfein said. Yeah, folks openly talk, like our president,
who is talking about it. He's been talking about it.
It's no longer a bipolar world out there where it's just us and the Soviet Union. We've got other players out there who have nuclear capability, he said. It's never been more important to make sure that we get this mission right. During his trip across the country, Goldfein had encouraged airmen to think beyond Cold War uses for ICBMs, bombers, and nuclear cruise missiles. Asked if placing B-52s back on alert, as they were for decades, would help with deterrence, Goldfein said, well, it's hard to say. Really depends on who, what kind of behavior we're talking about, and whether we're paying attention to our readiness status, he said. Already, various improvements have been made to prepare the Air Force base at Barksdale to return B-52s to an alert posture. This report goes on to note that there's a hangar nearby, an old concrete building nearby the nearby these strips where the B-52 crews would sleep during the Cold War, ready to run their aircraft and take off at a moment's notice. That structure is being renovated. Beds are being installed for more than 100 crew members. More than enough for the crews that would man bombers positioned on the 9 alert pads outside the building. Barksdale and other bases with nuclear bombers are preparing to build storage facilities for a new nuclear cruise missile that is under development. Goldfein received updates during his trip on the preliminary work for a proposed replacement for the 400-plus Minuteman III intercontinental ballistic missiles and the new long-range cruise missile. But, of course, if any other countries develop ICBMs, like, say, North Korea or Iran, this president has suggested that we should go to war with them. To which I say, WTF. Stephen Schwartz, however, had a much more measured response. He's the co-author of the book Atomic Audit, The Cost of Consequences, Costs and Consequences of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Since 1940, and an adjunct professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. I hope we're going to be able to talk to him more in the days ahead. We're trying to get in touch with him, but he goes by Atomic Analyst on Twitter. He says, what's the real justification for this other than the U.S. Air Force desire to make the Triad's bomber leg more visible? He says B-52s have been on armed ground alert for more than 26 years. I should say haven't. He says they haven't been on armed ground alert for more than 26 years.
So for 26 years, we have not had this ground alert, is what he's saying.
Suddenly we need to. Hmm. He says, are we afraid of a first strike by North Korea? By Russia? By China? B-52s were last on ground alert back in 1991. There were about 40 spread across several bases. He says doing that again would be very expensive and points out that we already maintain some 400 single warhead ICBMs that are already on 24/7 alert, plus 5 ballistic missile submarines on hard alert, carrying hundreds of ballistic missiles armed with some 400 to 500 warheads, not to mention some 7 other submarines transiting to and from patrol areas. Why isn't that sufficient to deter adversaries and reassure allies? Don't know. He says returning fueled and armed B-52 bombers to 24/7 ground alert will needlessly increase the risk of a serious nuclear accident. And then he adds, P.S., if you think Russia won't see this as provocative and react accordingly, I've got a lovely and profitable Trump casino to sell you. In the meantime, I know we have to get to our guest here momentarily, but some lawmakers are now citing the deaths of 4 U.S. soldiers ambushed by terrorists in Niger to call on Congress to finally reconsider the authority that has been granted, the broad authority that has been granted to the President of the United States, any President of the United States, through the Authorization of Use of Military Force, the AUMF, that was passed after the 9/11 attacks back in 2001, and have been used to justify wars everywhere since then. including attacks on Syria, which had clearly had nothing to do with 9/11. Now, committee chair in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker, said in a statement that the current threats make it perhaps more important than ever that we have a sober national conversation about Congress's constitutional role in authorizing the use of military force. Yes, current threats from whom? I don't think he says, but yes, Senator Corker, I think that would be appropriate. Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, says the same. So, you know, that would have been nice rather than lauding Donald Trump lobbing those missiles into the sovereign nation of Syria a few months ago. It would have been nice had they said at the same time, called him out for that and asked where the president thinks he gets his authority to do so. He does cite the AUMF for that. So, yeah, it is time, especially now that you have what appears to be a president threatening nuclear war against North Korea and the U.S. military now actually preparing for such a war. How far is this going to go? And as usual, will Congress wait until after something unspeakable has happened to actually take action? My guess is yes, but I suppose I have gotten cynical in my old age. Meanwhile, we have some 3.5 million U.S. citizens who have been without water and without power for over a month, many of them still without running water or other basic services and still waiting for billions of dollars in relief aid to allow them to fix it. Let's take a quick break here. We'll find out what is being done to restore Puerto Rico's power grid some 33 days after Hurricane Maria first made landfall and what should be done to avoid such crises in the future. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Electricity is something you don't notice until it's gone, writes Vox.com's Yochi Driesen from Puerto Rico today. On the mainland U.S., where power outages are rare and brief, he writes, Americans are used to simply flipping a switch and watching the lights come on, plugging in an air conditioner, and feeling the cold air and trusting that your refrigerator will keep fresh food and milk from going bad. When the power goes out, that sense of comfort quickly disappears, Driesen says. The parts of daily life that were once taken for granted are suddenly gone, with no clear sense of when they'll be back. To not have power, to be literally and figuratively in the dark, is to leave the modern world and retreat into an older and more precarious one in the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. That's Puerto Rico's new normal. According to the FEMA website, as of October 23, that's 33 days after Maria first made landfall, 82% of Puerto Rican customers are without electricity still. 26% are without running water. All of that while the temperature is a very muggy 85 degrees in San Juan today. Driesen writes, the lack of electricity doesn't simply mean months, yes, months of hardship for the hundreds of thousands of Puerto Ricans who will be without air conditioners, fans, televisions, and refrigerators for the foreseeable future. It's also significantly slowing the entire U.S. relief effort and preventing other vital parts of the island's battered infrastructure from coming back online. Internet and cell phone service cannot be fully restored without a steady flow of electricity to individual cell towers. The pumps, filtration systems, and other equipment used to treat sewage and provide clean drinking water also cannot function without power. The lack of electricity is significantly slowing the entire U.S. relief effort on Puerto Rico. People need to understand that this is not something that can be turned on tomorrow, says Jose Sanchez, who is leading the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers program to restore the electric grid across Puerto Rico. This is something that's going to take months to fix. Sanchez tells Vox.com that the Corps could eventually bring at least 500 of its employees to the island. Well, what's the holdup, Mr. Sanchez? Along with some 1,000 private contractors. The island, he says, can't recover, much less prosper, without a power grid that is back up and running across the island of some 3.5 million U.S. citizens who continue to suffer and face dangers from heat, bacterial diseases, inoperable sewage and water systems, food shortages, and hospitals and medical facilities still only partially operating and relying on diesel-fueled generators to keep the lights on at all, to perform important medical procedures like surgery, as well as keep patients and their medications cool and safe. Sanchez says, I think of electricity like water, as a basic need and a basic requirement to have a semi-normal life. Electricity, he says, is the linchpin of everything. All of that, as Vox reports, while both Puerto Rico itself and its government-owned power company, the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, or PREPA, has essentially declared forms of bankruptcy before the two record storms, Irma and then Maria, devastated the island. But as to those 1,000 private contractors Sanchez mentioned, well, that could be a signal of other problems to come. Ramon Cruz, a former commissioner of the Puerto Rico Energy Commission, warned recently in an op-ed for The Hill that even amidst the suffering, Puerto Ricans must be wary of offers to help solve the island's energy crisis. After having lived through the worst and gotten used to misery, Cruz writes, the people of Puerto Rico are about to experience the sequel to disaster. Vultures will arrive to feast on the opportunities presented by recovery efforts. Here to discuss those opportunities and those feasting vultures is Ramon Cruz. As I said, he's a former commissioner of the Puerto Rico Energy Commission and a former vice president of the Puerto Rico Environmental Quality Board. He is currently an independent environmental policy consultant for UN environmental processes like the Paris Climate Agreement and the UN Sustainable Development Goals. He also serves on the Sierra Club's National Board of Directors. Ramon Cruz, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Well, thank you, and thanks, Brad, and to all your audience. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I want to talk, Ramon, about your vulture concerns and recommendations for how Puerto Rico needs to proceed toward a renewable energy future and a grid that will be less archaic and susceptible to the type of widespread outages and that it had seen even before Maria, but certainly after Maria. But since I know that you just arrived back to the mainland here, I think a week or so ago from Puerto Rico, and may now have brought a cold with you, so thank you for joining us anyway. I want to get a sense first of how things are going right now on the ground there in Puerto Rico. We hear, you know, one thing from the President of the United States and something else coming out of Puerto Rico itself. Can you give us sort of an update on what you saw when you were there?
Well, unfortunately, many of the stories that you see in the news are true. I mean, the recovery efforts were so slow to come from the federal government, even from the state government, that certainly makes us feel as second-class citizens. So it's basically what you see in the news, and sometimes even worse. The situation in the metropolitan area of San Juan, has definitely improved, but inside the island is definitely much worse, getting worse by the day. You know, when you don't have electricity for a whole month, mm-hmm. when you don't know when it's your next, hot meal that you're not using just, you know, canned sausages any kinds of canned food. Mm-hmm. So it's very heartbreaking when you see the amount of, I mean, when you look into the horizon, when you only saw trees in the past, now looks like more like a fire went through or a war, mm-hmm. where you barely have any trees to provide, you know, any shadows or any relief. When you drive, you know, and it's at night, and you only see with the lights of your car just mountains of debris on the side. So it is very chaotic. The intersection has no traffic lights. So it is really it becomes very chaotic to drive around. I remember coming to New York and then seeing all the so many families saying goodbye to each other because they're migrating basically to the U.S. At least to have some relief in the meantime. But I'm sure many of them will probably stay for good as the opportunities in the island are very scarce right now.
I'm struck, Ramon, you say things are getting worse. We're a month out from this thing, and it still feels, at least outside of the capital of San Juan, that things are getting worse, not yet better in those locations?
Yeah, because many, I mean, you still have towns that are not connected or that are not communicated at all. I cannot. My father, for example, lives in a town called Rio Grande. It's only about 45 minutes from San Juan. Still, I cannot talk to him on the phone. Mm. I know that you know, and they don't have any electricity nor water service. So for many, I mean, and imagine, you know, when you're a patient that needs, you know, special care, and you're in the mountains, in the town in the mountains, you may not have, you know, some of them have received a visit from the authorities only once, if any, you know, and to bring, you know, a couple of water bottles and some canned sausages or some, you know, yeah, I mean, the food in the FEMA, you know, packages sometimes are not the most healthy ones either. So yeah. So it's very unfortunate for many.
Donald Trump gave himself and the federal relief efforts a 10 out of 10, you may have heard, late last week when he was asked about it at the White House during a press avail with the Puerto Rican governor, Ricardo Rossello there. How would you rate the effort on that same scale, Ramon?
Well, you know, I mean, it's difficult to give grades given that I haven't graded any other relief efforts in the past. Mm. What I can say is that it's very unfortunate that he brings it back to himself and to what grade would he give, you know? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, who cares about what grade he gives if there are still people that have all these necessities, you know? So mm-hmm. it's really infuriating to see that that brings it back there, back to that. When he visited the island, he said, well, this is not major issue because not that many people, you know, were killed, you know, like Katrina. And, yeah, I mean, that happens because, you know, from the winds itself, you know, a lot of people may have concrete houses or they were able to seek refuge. But the fact that they lost everything and that they still haven't have access, they're, you know, drinking contaminated water in ways that are preventable, completely preventable, you know, then that's the real disaster. So in that case, I would definitely give, you know, if I could give negative points, I would give that.
We're told by Trump and other federal officials that the effort there is unprecedented, but that where food and water is getting to the island is not getting where it needs to be still now more than a month after the disaster, is that the federal government has been essentially laying blame at the foot of local officials rather than the federal government. I'm curious your response to that, Ramon.
Well, I mean, again, you need to have in moments like this, you need a complete coordination of all the efforts. And it's not only state versus federal. You know, here you needed to have somebody, you know, some central command that needed to call the shots, that needed to ease, you know, things like they gave a waiver of 10 days of the Jones Act that basically would allow other ships from other flags, other countries, mm-hmm. to come to the rescue, you know, in ways that U.S. ships haven't been able to. Now there's a lot of cargo there, but then all the bureaucracies to let it happen, to let it go through, you know, it's ridiculous. There's a lot of things that you cannot travel, that you cannot, you know, take by plane. Like, you know, a lot of lithium batteries, for example, mm-hmm. to power solar systems. So all that, we need to have. And yesterday I was talking to some friends and colleagues that work in the solar industry, and they're saying, you know, we got a great shipment of, 100 pallets, I think you call it, mm-hmm. in English, of, you know, solar panels. But still will take at least a month to go through all the shipping, you know, processes and all that. So you know, that's too bad that that's what's happening, you know. And still there's conversations of in Puerto Rico or in Congress, actually, of waiving environmental regulations. That's not the kind of regulations that you should be looking to ease these days. But yeah. It is a lot of the logistical and bureaucracies to get things inside the island, the Jones Act should be lifted, you know, at least a year, if not forever, for Puerto Rico. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, that's the kind of things where the federal government could actually help a lot.
Yeah, and you say there's 100 pallets of solar panels sitting there, not getting out where they need to be. And I want to ask you about rebuilding the grid and your recommendations and warnings there as well. But last question before we do, I want to just get, what do you find that Americans on the mainland here don't currently understand about this crisis in Puerto Rico? And more importantly, where would you send those people who would like to help somehow?
Well, there is a big effort, I think. I mean, in terms of human power, you have a lot of able Puerto Ricans to help.
Mm-hmm.
I think there should be, you know, somewhere where, you know, as a policy person, I think somewhere, Americans in the mainland could help a lot by putting pressure in their elected officials to then, have a decent relief package to Puerto Rico or to hurricane-affected areas, mm-hmm. you know, and to have, for example, a climate adaptation plan, you know, something. I think everywhere in the coast, everywhere that is vulnerable to climate change, to global warming, there should be a plan for how to deal with, you know, how to deal with essential infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that is extremely important. So it's the political pressure, then all the relief. You know, there's a lot of organizations that are providing relief. We're still in a survival mode. There's still a lot of organizations that are preparing food, preparing basic needs for Puerto Ricans. So I would say that, and then there's going to be a lot of materials needed. And materials, not so much. I mean, everything is welcomed, of course. But I would say water filtration, water filters,
mm-hmm.
Filtration plants, solar equipment that could work without, you know, without adding to the amount of debris and toxic waste that is being created. So batteries, of course, are needed. You couldn't find any D-size batteries in the island, or any, I mean, I didn't enter in any of the, mm-hmm. any sort that you could find any batteries at all. You mm-hmm. could not. So, you know, of course that's needed, but actually, you know, why not using solar lamps? Why not using, you know, chargers that you could put a solar cell
mm-hmm.
outside and charge your battery so that you can power a fan at night?
Yeah.
You know, so things like that are very much needed right now, desperately in the island.
Of course, that's not all that's desperately needed. Let me take a quick break and we'll come back with Ramon Cruz. I want to ask about this report from FEMA about the fluctuating power levels, which seems very strange. And, of course, about the vultures who are now descending on Puerto Rico and how Puerto Rico will be able to move forward appropriately and safely and smartly. All of that and more with Ramon Cruz, formerly of the Puerto Rico Energy Commission. I'm Brad Friedman. This is your Bradcast. Yes, please. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. I'm speaking with Ramon Cruz, former commissioner of the Puerto Rico Energy Commission, now on the National Board of Directors on the Sierra Club and an advisor to the UN concerning environmental issues. Ramon, the power has been restored in Puerto Rico now, supposedly to about 20%, at least as of midweek last week, according to FEMA. But by Friday, it had gone down to 15%. Ramon Cruz, as a former commissioner on the Puerto Rico Energy Commission, do you have any idea what's happening? Why the power is fluctuating even after being restored in some areas?
Well, the main problem is that most of the transmission lines are down. So the transmission lines means, you know, those huge towers that you may see when you're driving through in a highway, mm-hmm. and you see them that they're very big. A lot of those are down. So you had Puerto Rico, even though the territory is small, you have in the center of the island, you have a lot of mountains. And the big generation, most of the generation or the majority is happening in the southern part of the island, where you have an easier way of getting in fuel, et cetera, because the Caribbean Sea is much more calm than the Atlantic Ocean that is in the north of the island. So most of the generation happens in the south. However, most of the demand is in the north. Mm-hmm. So you need those transmission lines to bring the power from the south to the north. What happened, and you saw that fluctuation in the grid, is because the big generators didn't suffer as much as the line. Mm-hmm. So they put back up the generator that is near San Juan, but the demand is so strong, so mm-hmm. huge, that it basically made the system collapse. Mm. And then you had that problem. So you need definitely the generation from the south to cover for that. Otherwise, it's going to be difficult to bring back. So basically, they brought they lit up too quickly. Uh-huh. And then people were just, thirsty of power. And, yeah. and that made the system collapse. But I'm sure they can bring that easier than bringing some of the towers that were down from the transmission line.
So the generating plants themselves, in theory, they're fine, they're working, but there's just basically no transmission wires over the mountains from the south to the north, or at least, I guess, three or four of them are down at this point?
Well, let me backtrack then a little bit. It's not that they're fine. They are as they were before the hurricane, or didn't suffer as much.
Right.
I have to definitely say, a lot of these generators are decades old. Mm-hmm. Puerto Rico didn't invest for decades in the, or PREPA didn't invest in new generators. So you have these monstrosities of this very centralized system that were there, mm-hmm. seeing some of them, since the 60s or 70s, and so they're very inefficient. They operate with some of the dirtiest fuels right now, mm-hmm. and they should have been changed and retired long time ago, but because of several reasons of mismanagement, everything from mismanagement, corruption, lack of capital, lack of creativity, of bad business models, etc., they were not changed, mm-hmm. and now you see this kind of effect.
And of course, I didn't mean that they were fine, that they were great. I meant that they were generally working in the state they were before, but it's the power lines that are holding us up. You write in your piece at The Hill that you are a strong advocate for solar and believe it is essential for cities and states nationwide to commit to 100% renewable energy. Nonetheless, it is important to proceed with caution so that these goals are achieved the right way. What does that mean, and how should Puerto Rico consider rebuilding its power grid At this point, even while it's struggling just to get power to its residents, citizens across the island.
The problem usually with solar, and again, I'm a strong advocate. I think cities in the U.S. should mm-hmm. be switching to that, pledging. We have a big campaign at the Sierra Club on switching to 100% renewables. But you have to do it. Not all the grids are equipped to, okay, I put the solar panels and that's it. There's a bunch of not only technical but regulatory issues that you have to take, mm-hmm. That you have to take into consideration. Now, in a place like Puerto Rico, that we have abundant sun for long periods of time, and the whole year you could do that, you still have moments of the day that you don't have electricity, right? I mean, you don't have the sun.
Sunshine, right.
Sun energy. So you have to deal with storage. Storage, unfortunately, is quite expensive, to power the level of demand that you require, right? Mm-hmm. So there are ways of dealing with that with more efficient equipment, both at the consumer end, but also at the generation. So if you would have generators that are smaller, that are more distributed around the grid, you could deal with cloudy days or how to deal with the demand at night in an easier way. And in that way also, whenever a hurricane, with Maria, it would have been very tough because it really devastated the whole island.
Mm-hmm.
But we have had hurricanes in the past where part of the island gets wrecked, the other part of the island could pick it up or, could help out. So if you had smaller grid distributed generation to cover for that and then, put solar panels all over the place, whoever can afford it, will have better batteries.
Mm-hmm.
But if not, at least you will ensure that there's enough storage for critical infrastructure such as hospitals, sewage treatment plants, water plants, city halls, where you have the center of, government making, key decisions in this moment so that they don't have to be doing it in the dark, and in the dark, by that I mean without knowing what's happening in the rest of the world. And that's what was happening in many of the municipalities in Puerto Rico.
Elon Musk of Tesla has offered to come in and help build microgrids with solar panels and massive battery storage all over the island. I believe German company Sonnen has suggested something similar. Are those sort of decentralized microgrids what you are talking about? Or maybe this is an and/or, Ramon. Are those the vultures that you're concerned about coming into the island?
Well, I hope they're not. So far, they seem to have donated a couple of the power walls.
Mm-hmm.
They are. There's a lot of opportunity, and I don't know what's in their mind. However, I must say, everybody who can help, the help is welcome. However, to make a dent into Puerto Rico's, demand, you would need so many of these that it would be impossible to cover for that. If one of those batteries costs $6,000, over a bit over $6,000, and even if they make it at cost, $5,000, how many families would be able to do that? So certainly you may be able to power a key infrastructure and hospitals
mm-hmm.
with those, but can you really bring back demand the way it was? It would have to be a mix of things. So one, putting all your eggs in one basket is not possible. A lot of those batteries depend on lithium. Right now it's only a handful of countries that have that. So far, everything is going well, but what happens if, the whole world switches to solar and the only way to do it is with a lithium-based battery, and you have a cartel like the OPEC, into that. So there are many what-ifs. So I mean, Mr. Musk's, proposal is great. I think definitely it's part of the answer. They should be, and, you know, the more they can show the world that this is possible, the better it is. However, you know, you have to do many other things, to be sure that you're covering all your bases.
There was
so one solution fits all. It's usually not the answer.
There was another solution, of course, other than solar, is wind. I know there's a lot of wind in Puerto Rico. The Vox piece that I was quoting from earlier notes that Puerto Rico has plenty of sun and wind to allow for solar and wind power. And though one of the solar plants, I guess one of the solar farms there, was damaged by the storm, there's a wind turbine farm that is said to be in perfect operating condition to power tens of thousands of homes. But it just needs power, apparently, from the main electric grid to essentially turn on the turbines. How could that or should that have been avoided? I mean, it seems crazy that you've got these working turbines that they can't use simply because they just need enough electricity, essentially, to flip the switch to turn them on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know about that particular case, but again, in general, it's healthier if you use a diverse portfolio mm-hmm. of sources. So you will need to make a transition. You will need to plan, and there's an opportunity now to make it happen. Tidal power as well, you know, hydro, different aspects. You have to be sure that none all of the, you know, that you're not basically just betting on one technology.
And
in Puerto Rico, there's an opportunity to develop a few of them.
You warn about vultures now coming in. Well, there'll be, there's some $5 billion in a disaster relief loan that is supposed not just a gift, a grant, but a loan to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands that will, for some reason, need to be paid back. But who will... You talk about the vultures, and they'll be looking at that sort of money, obviously, that is now will soon be available, hopefully, to the island. But who will decide how Puerto Rico moves forward? Will it be Puerto Rico itself, or will the federal government, because they now are, you know, loaning this money, will they have the say on how things are moving forward? Are conditions being attached to those relief efforts?
Well, to be honest, given the little that has been shown so far, we don't know. I would like to think that the state government has a lot to say in teaming up with the Corps of Engineers and FEMA. However, if you look at the example that we have so far on the Whitefish contract, it is a mystery, and it is, I think, unfortunate that, you know, a small, quite inexperienced, company in Montana is now in charge of building up the grid in Puerto Rico. And so when being asked about it, what I see, it's a lot of pointing fingers saying, oh, no, it was the feds who recommended. No, and the feds say, no, it was the Puerto Rico government who did it. And regardless of who did it at the end, you know, there were options like the mutual assistance program of the power association that, you know, basically puts all the utilities in the U.S. together. You know, they could have been the ones doing this, you know, and did they need more money up front or not? You know, aren't those terms negotiable? It is very shady how this contract happened, and that's why, you know, because of instances like that, you know, for us that are, you know, on the side of watchdogs or transparency of being, you know, wanting policies and programs to be much more transparent and to benefit the most, then it's extremely alarming what we're seeing so far.
It is.
And I hope, yeah.
Yeah, well, when these tiny companies out of nowhere suddenly have these huge multi-million-dollar contracts to restore power to Puerto Rico, and nobody can really understand or explain the process by which they have gained those contracts, that is disturbing. Ramon Cruz, I've got just a minute or two left here. I know you you had mentioned this in part and noted it over the weekend to me via email that there is an important Senate hearing on hurricane relief happening on Tuesday in the U.S. Senate, and they're discussing waiving environmental regulations. What does that mean? What sort of environmental regulations are they waiving, and what are your concerns?
Well, I have to point out that that actually the hearing was canceled. Nobody, I mean, I'm not completely sure why. So it has been postponed, but there's no setup date yet.
Okay.
But it was on the schedule that that was before. They mentioned the waiving of environmental regulations.
Mm-hmm.
You know that it is important to see the air quality regulations. I know that that in the rounds in Washington there is a well, and I will throw it out there, you know, a company like Energy Answers that are trying to build an incinerator for a long time, and there has been, you know, obstacle after obstacle, and they haven't been able to do it. Now, I am sure there are probably ones or companies like that looking to relax the environmental regulations. They all claim that it's state-of-the-art facilities. If it's state-of-the-art, then why do you have to ease some of the local environmental regulations? So, or even if some under NEPA, the Environmental Protection Act or Clean Water or Clean Air Act at the federal level, they should not be lax right now, especially when you have people drinking water from rivers. So that is very important to keep an eye, keep a watch on that, and for American citizens in the mainland to help the brothers and sisters in the island, and you that have political clout in the state through Congress, then contact your Congress members, your senators, and be sure that there's no relaxation of those environmental regulations for Puerto Rico.
We are doing what we can here to get the word out, Ramon Cruz, and your help is appreciated. I hope you'll stay in touch with us. You write at the end of your op-ed at The Hill, which we'll point people to, that we, the people of Puerto Rico, are in desperate need, but we shouldn't trade the next 50 years of electricity away for 1 year of urgency. It's time to look out for the collective well-being of all Puerto Ricans and maintain constant vigilance in the face of the inevitable fact that vultures may come dressed as angels. Indeed. Ramon, please stay in touch with us as those angel-dressed vultures show up in Puerto Rico. We'll do our best to get out the word, and we'll point folks towards your work at The Hill and also on the Twitters, where you are Ramon Cruz Diaz. Anywhere else that we should send folks for your websites or anything else, Ramon?
Well, right now, I mean, the Sierra Club, we have a campaign to redirecting a lot of the funding that we're getting back to community groups in the island. So far, we have we're working with about 25 to 30 different groups in the island, so that's a good point. But there's so much need that I'm sure any of the groups that you decide to donate is good. So thanks to you, Brad, and thanks to your audience.
Thank you very much. That, of course, is at sierraclub.org. You can stop by there. Ramon Cruz, former Puerto Rican Energy Commission official, now advising the UN on various environmental processes and on the National Board of Directors at the Sierra Club. Ramon Cruz, thanks a bunch. Hope to talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
Wow, this is going to be a very, very big, very complex, very difficult project, but I hope that we get the kind of oversight we need.
Well, and it all must be done
While the nation right now, while the island, I'm sorry, is out of power across the whole, you know, so there's this desperate need to just get any power up at all right now.
And then figure out how to build for the future.
Right. So they essentially are going to have to rebuild the grid twice. It seems like very complicated, very messy. And yes, the vultures are circling to try to take even more advantage of these poor folks. All right. Thank you, Des. Our producer, Desi Doyen. My thanks, of course, to Ramon Cruz and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's broadcast, you can download it and all of the others anytime for free at bradblog.com or at your favorite podcast site, such as iTunes. Hope you'll give us a good review, a good comment, wherever you download it from. You can drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. My thanks, as ever, to those of you who actively support The Bradcast by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. It is greatly appreciated. Any support you can offer, we thank you. All right, is that it? I think that's it for now. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, Puerto Rico. Good luck, world.